its current state here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan's educational landscape keeps changing, sometimes dramatically. MLive reports today that Albion High School will cease to exist. After a vote of its Board of Education last night, the district plans to send its high schoolers to Marshall High School, but will continue to operate a K-8 system. Albion School's board member Don Phillips is quoted in this MLive article. "This is not a reflection of Albion High School students. This is a reflection about fiscal stewardship and changes that have been happening in our state. As a longtime board member, it's always been cut, 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 cut at Albion Public Schools." That's a scenario a lot of school board members are probably familiar with. But he continues, "I have not seen any forward-thinking ideas until now." So the end of Albion High School apparently is in the works. We've got an interesting show for you here today. Later on this hour, we talk with an MSU professor of geological sciences, Michael Velbel. Michael is studying a particular meteorite that may tell us more about the planet Mars. And we talk about a talk with an author raised in Lansing who's written a book, Nothing But Blue Skies. Edward McClelland attended Sexton High School, and he's written a book about the rise and fall of the industrial Midwest. That's all coming up on the program. But first today, economic developers in Michigan suggest there may be a silver lining to the Great Recession and the state's well-documented decline in manufacturing. Some point to a greater awareness of entrepreneurialism and entrepreneurial activity. Joining current state to talk about entrepreneurialism here in Michigan, Matt Burbeck, director of the MSU Product Center for Ag and Natural Resources. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, good morning.
Matt's focus is on agriculture and food product businesses specifically. And on the phone, Tom Donaldson is director of the Lansing office of the Michigan Small Business Technology and Development Center, who works closely with business startups and existing businesses. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning, Mark. Glad to be here.
Great. Let's start with you, Matt. Remind our listeners what the MSU Product Center does.
We are a full-service business center here based at Michigan State that helps new and existing businesses start new food and agricultural product lines. So we have a portfolio of services that we offer new and existing businesses in creating new product lines using the assets of MSU. So the food lab, the meat lab, the Department of Food Science, so we can do nutritional labels. So we have an incredible range of assets that we can draw upon here at MSU in helping people create these new food products and new businesses.
And people come to you, they have an idea, and you assess that idea for them, talk about the challenges that are involved, and just evaluate their ideas. Is that it?
Absolutely. We take everybody through from concept through to actually product development. So they'll come with an idea, they may come in with a recipe in their back pocket, they may come with an existing product and want to expand it. But we really take them right through the process of everything they need to know in what it would take to bring a new product to fruition, including food safety and all the rules and regulations that go with that in bringing that product to market.
Tom Donaldson, technology is in the name of your organization, the Small Business Technology and Development Center. How big of a focus is technology in the services you offer?
Well, we offer somewhat similar services to what Matt described for food and those sorts of things. But we have a technology team that focuses on tech-based businesses. They often have some type of patented technology or some type of intellectual property. Many of them are businesses that sort of spin out of Michigan State. Maybe some research has been done there or in another college, but not always. And sometimes these technology businesses are a little different than a traditional Main Street business in that they often need equity funding. They need investors as opposed to, it's hard to go to the bank and get a bank to fund your 2 years of research and development that you need to do to bring your software product or your new pharmaceutical drug that's going to cure cancer or whatever you're working on. That technology project sometimes can take years before you have any sales revenue. So our tech team really specializes in working with those types of companies to help them through those early years and see if they can make it.
Are you saying that funding is what you help people with most often?
Oh, it's a big part of what we do. Yeah, capital. You know, the companies we worked with last year across the state of Michigan, we helped them raise over $100 million in capital. So that's a big part of why businesses come to us for assistance.
Both you guys have such an interesting angle on entrepreneurialism in Michigan. From your perspective, Matt Burbeck, has the awareness of entrepreneurialism of an ordinary person launching a product or a service commercially, has awareness of that as a career option grown in recent years?
I think it has. I mean, entrepreneurship, and I'm sure Tom will agree, that the entrepreneurship is alive and well. I think that we've gone through some economic woes, obviously, in America, and especially in Michigan, and I think that's driven a lot of people to go back to entrepreneurship, as people have either lost jobs or hours have been cut back or overtime has been taken away. I think entrepreneurs and individual people have looked for supplementary businesses to start up. And food and agriculture has been one of those things that I think they've seen as an opportunity. Everybody has that favorite recipe or that favorite product that they think they can create. Mm-hmm. So it's alive and well. It will be interesting to see that as the economy picks up, and I think your sentence of that there is a limelight, I think we are coming out of the recession and things are getting better. It's going to be interesting to see how entrepreneurship continues to grow and be driven. And what the outcome is going to be over the next sort of 3 to 5 years.
So a certain amount of instability actually fuels the entrepreneurial movement is what you seem to be suggesting.
I think so. I think it adds. I think that, you know, we've always been an entrepreneurial state. You know, Michigan is very entrepreneurial. I mean, again, in the food and agricultural arena, we have such a diversity and plethora of products and things that we grow here that we've always seen a whole heap of activity in the food movement as it grows in the state. But I think we always see as things are bad, entrepreneurship, I think Americans are very good at using their resources well and looking for opportunities about how they can supplement income, and I think entrepreneurship is one of those areas.
Tom Donaldson, have you seen that in recent years? I mean, when the Great Recession took hold, did you see a spike in activity?
Absolutely, we did. Yeah, on a couple of levels. Number one, we saw people, bright, educated people who were suddenly without a job. We saw a lot of engineers from, you know, Ford, GM, Chrysler, that suddenly were without a job. And these are talented, skilled people that had worked on big projects for the big three. And some of them decided to start their own business. And maybe it was something, an area that they had worked in at Ford or GM. And maybe that company decided not to pursue a certain type of product or technology, and so some of these guys took this as an opportunity to go forward with that, and we saw some success with that. I know a gentleman that I worked with got laid off from a large retailer that I won't mention, but we all shop there, and he was sort of a mid-management guy and suddenly without a job, and so he went out and started a service company, and he's doing very well. Now he's planning to sell the business, but he's got about 5 employees. It's turned into a very nice business for him. What I guess one of the things we saw, I agree with Matt that certainly we are an entrepreneurial state. We've seen this, but I'm seeing more in that age 50 plus area that lots of people at that age group are going into entrepreneurship. And I've seen some stats from the Small Business Administration recently that support that. Partly because those are the guys that a lot of people lost their jobs during the recession.
Yeah, but they've also got a certain amount of career experience that gives them presumably a springboard into launching their own business, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, they have the experience. Many of them had some savings, which helps, you know, because it does take some capital to start a business. And they had good networks of people that they could draw on to help them as they plan their business and launch their business, because that's just as important as the own knowledge and the capital is to have that. You know, you don't know everything, and so you've got to reach out to other expertise in the community that can help you fill the gaps in your own knowledge. And these people are well connected.
Matt Burbeck, do you see younger people, though, too?
Yeah, absolutely. But I agree with Tom. I mean, that older bracket is a growing, you know, and Tom and I have both worked and I'm sure they won't mind me mentioning them, but we have three older ladies that are in their 60s. that have started a food business, and both Tom and I have helped that company move towards some very good numbers in this day. But the interesting thing with the younger crowd is that they're much more sophisticated in how they're starting their businesses. You know, when I began entrepreneurship 10 years ago, or when I got involved with the Product Center, people weren't so sophisticated in how they were looking to start their business. People are much more knowledgeable. People are much more sophisticated. The world of technology is much more advanced. Food safety has become a bigger issue. I think that entrepreneurs have become much more savvy, and therefore younger people that have now got involved in entrepreneurship, they're coming in much more intelligent about how they need to start these new businesses.
Is the Product Center's focus on agriculture and food products a result of the university's history as an agricultural school?
I think it has an incredible benefit. I think the MSU has an amazing amount of assets that can help Michigan start new food businesses. And I think MSU being known in the food and agriculture arena adds credibility to what we're doing with entrepreneurship in the state.
Tom Donaldson, is there a particular area of opportunity that you might be tempted to identify here in May of 2013 as a promising area for an aspiring entrepreneur?
Well, you know, I don't know that I'll pick out any one particular industry or type of business, but I will say that
has kind of a bad reputation these days, right? We don't pick winners. We don't pick favorites, right?
that's true. But I guess what I will say is that what I'm seeing is how the web is opening up opportunities for people, whether they're running a business out of their home, out of their backseat of their trunk of their car. You can appear big when you're without investing a huge amount of money. So what we're seeing is the great opportunity is people can get out and test their ideas at a relatively low cost. So the bar has lowered where 10 years ago or so, it might have cost, $100,000 or $500,000 to get in a particular type of business and be a competitor and compete for business. Now you can maybe do it for $10,000 or $25,000 or $50,000, a lot less money in many cases, because the costs of computer equipment and high-speed internet and all these things have dropped so much that those opportunities are there for so many people to take advantage of now.
Tom Donaldson is the director of the Lansing office of the Michigan Small Business Technology and Development Center. Matt Burbeck is director of the MSU Product Center for Ag and Natural Resources. Great discussion, guys. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. To find out more about the potential for life on Mars, some scientists aren't looking up, but down. A team of researchers is examining meteorites from the red planet to help determine if conditions on Mars were ever suitable for sustaining life. MSU Geological Sciences Professor Michael Velbel is part of the research team. He joins us from Washington, D.C., where he's currently serving as a senior fellow at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. Michael Velbel, welcome.
Thank you, and good morning, Mark.
Good morning. The meteor, you're studying a particular meteorite. Do I have this right?
Yes.
Okay, and this is a meteorite that formed on Mars more than a billion years ago. Remind our listeners how it was this meteorite from Mars ended up here.
If you look up at the moon at night, you see craters all over the surface of the moon.
Yes.
And if you look at pictures coming back from NASA missions, you see that cratering is probably one of the most widespread phenomena on the surface of any planet. So sometime, approximately 10 to 12 million years ago, a small impact formed on Mars. And during the formation of that crater, some of the ejected material was ejected fast enough that it could leave Mars and go into orbit around the sun. And then about 10, 11 million years later, the orbit of that meteorite crossed the orbit of Earth at the time when both the meteorite or meteoroid and Earth were at the same place, and it entered Earth's atmosphere, and the pieces that survived got recovered and became the stuff we study.
Where was it discovered?
This particular meteorite was recovered in Antarctica.
And how much do you have to work with here? I'm under the impression most meteors burn up before they strike planet Earth. It's not that many, at least that's what I've always heard, it's not that many that actually make it intact to the Earth's surface. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. Typically, whatever does make it to the surface is usually about only 5 or 10% of how much there was when it arrived at Earth's atmosphere. The rest does melt very quickly because of the intense frictional heating with Earth's atmosphere. What we had to work with was a piece that when it arrived was about a large tennis ball, or you know, between tennis ball and softball size, about a pound and a half was the initial mass that was available when it was recovered in Antarctica. And little tiny bits of that have been subdivided. There are several hundred allocations of that material that have been allocated to different scientists. We had about a half dozen very thin slices of the material mounted to pieces of glass, microscope slides, each about the size of a nickel.
And what can you learn from this? Or what are you learning from this?
What we're learning is a couple things. One is what can happen to Mars minerals when they're exposed to water. Even if nothing had happened on Mars, the fact that these meteorites get exposed to some water and some oxygen when they're on Earth tells us that they're kind of an unintended natural experiment in how those minerals react with water and what kind of products and changes in chemistry results from that. Now, it turns out that in the very few such meteorites that were recovered right after they fell, similar kinds of minerals are found in some of them, telling us that some of those same processes happened on Mars.
How about that? What is the best current thinking, then, regarding water on Mars, past or present?
Best current thinking is that there was liquid water in a variety of kinds of environments, rivers, ponds, lots of groundwater, that there was in the past. There may still be locally occasional occurrences where water ice might be close enough to the surface that every now and then it melts. There are occasional hints in some of the data from one of the orbiter missions, some images of what look like little kind of wet landslides that only happen in the springtime in the hemisphere on Mars when subsurface ice might be melting. But the atmospheric pressure on Mars is way too low for there to be any liquid water persisting at the surface. It would go directly from ice to vapor. And if there were a little bit of liquid there, it wouldn't last at all. It wouldn't sit around, it wouldn't pond. So small quantities, maybe every now and then at present, large quantities in the past. And that's why looking at a meteorite like this is great, because the meteorite crystallized about, it's an igneous rock, a kind of a volcanic rock that crystallized about a billion years ago. And so it's been sitting on Mars with the opportunity to be exposed to any little bits of moisture that might have existed since then.
Now, does this meteorite have a name? I mean, have you named it like, like the moons of Saturn or anything like that?
Yeah, all meteorites get named for where they are found. And when many, many of them are found in the same area, then they get a name and a number. This particular meteorite is Miller Range 03346.
Okay.
It was found in the Miller Range of Antarctica.
Okay.
Along with hundreds of others that same collecting year and many more in collecting seasons before and after.
When was the meteorite you are studying actually unearthed, so to speak?
It was recovered in 2003.
Okay.
By a field team. The United States and the Japanese each send a field team to Antarctica every year to collect meteorites, and the U.S. team recovered this meteorite in 2003.
What specific detail about Mars do you think you're most likely to learn with more study of the Miller Range meteorites? Can you point to one particular thing that you feel like you're close to discovering or that you could discover?
Yes. Yeah. Some of my colleagues in preliminary work on this meteorite found a few occurrences of a mineral that seems to contain the two isotopes of hydrogen in very unusual abundances. If we could demonstrate that kind of mineral in this particular rock didn't form on Earth and wasn't modified by processes on Earth, then that isotope ratio would actually be a clue to the evolution of the atmosphere of Mars.
How interesting. You were able to identify this meteorite as coming from Mars. Is it easy to identify the origin of the other meteorites that survive arrival here on Earth?
There are a couple ways of doing that. The word, if you were the easy, is it easy to do? It can be done. And for most varieties of meteorites, not just the ones that come from Mars, but for most of them, the researchers know at least what kind of body they came from. Was it some particular kind of asteroid? Was it the moon? Was it Mars? Although there are only a few instances where we know specifically which asteroid, for example, or specifically which planet a meteorite came from.
So a meteorite is apt to come from a planet, an asteroid, or the moon, most likely?
The ones that we have all seem to have come from one of the three kinds of places you listed.
And yep. What's the future of your work? How long will you be looking at this at the Miller Range meteorites?
I'm continuing to work on it, looking for other properties, for other features in it that provide clues to different aspects of how water reacted with these minerals. That's actually part of what I'm doing here at the Smithsonian.
And briefly, we've got 30 seconds. Tell our listeners about the Mars One mission.
Mars One. One of a number of interesting proposals for getting people to Mars. Eventually, one of those proposals will turn into a real attempt, and eventually one of those will be successful. I look forward to hearing more about it.
Fascinating. Michael Velbel is an MSU Geological Sciences professor. He's currently serving as a senior fellow at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Mark.
Coming up, Lansing-born author Edward McClelland and his book, Nothing But Blue Skies, and we learn more about the great work of the LCC Foundation in our Current State Neighbors in Action segment. That's all on the way on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Stay with us. It's Current State on WKAR. Glad you're here. There's a cluster of blossoming trees that I walk past every morning and every evening to and from my office here in East Lansing. And I have to say, it's that time of year that this is the most fragrant group of blossoming trees I've ever been around. I'm not sure the variety, but it is it's a stop you in your tracks kind of experience. It is just overwhelming. I think I picked up the scent of these trees maybe from 40 feet away last night, and it's a not so subtle reminder that the time of year when these trees are blossoming is brief. So stop and smell the fruit trees, okay? Take care of that. They will be gone. You know, the blossoms will be gone very, very shortly. It's Wednesday, and it's time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we feature the Lansing Community College Foundation, which offers more than 300 scholarships to students in need. And here to tell us more about the LCC Foundation is Executive Director Dan McKean. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Mark.
And joining him is George Garza, an LCC student and scholarship recipient. Welcome, George.
Thanks, Mark.
Tell us about the LCC Foundation. How long have you been around? How busy are you?
Well, we're a little over 30 years old, and it's pretty easy to say who we are. We are an independent 501(c) nonprofit from Lansing Community College, and we exist really to be the philanthropic arm for the college. Our primary mission is scholarships, but we also support, our donors support LCC programs and capital drives.
From year to year, about how much money do you dispense in scholarships?
We give out about $325,000 in scholarships every year.
That's great.
And that's why we're glad that George is here, because he really represents the importance of our story.
What are some of the scholarships that you offer?
We have general foundation scholarships, where we have the ability to award them to students based on financial needs, grade point average, and a personal statement that they might make. We also have donor-directed scholarships, where people who really have a vested interest in setting up criteria that's important to them, supporting students in specific programs or supporting students with different backgrounds.
George, I understand you have a family and you're studying automotive technology. Why did you decide to go back to school?
Well, I worked in a factory for 12 years, lost my job, and tried to look for more work, and it's just not there.
Had to reinvent yourself.
Yes.
That's right. What was that process like for you?
Well, it was tough at first.
Three kids. Okay.
A wife. What I thought was a stable job,
yeah.
A really good job, and it went away really quick, so it was kind of a shock to try to get back.
What was the application process like?
For the scholarship, it was very easy. I just filled out a paper and turned it in, and then I got a response, and they said, hey, we'd like to help you out.
How exactly did the foundation help George then? And what were the criteria then when you saw George's application? How did that play out?
Well, George is a good example of our ability to match our donor interest with a student's need. George is a recipient of the Ron Burke Help-A-Wrench Scholarship. Ron Burke was an LCC student who passed away, and his brother and sister are funding a yearly scholarship specifically for a student who would be studying in the automotive technology area, and that met the criteria that George had. So George was able to receive this foundation scholarship, and our donors are thrilled to hear from students like him who write a thank you note, and it continues to help them remember their brother and know that the students in automotive technologies are being helped.
George, was there a point when you decided then, I'm not going to just conduct a job search, I'm going to retool myself, I'm going to pick up new skills?
Definitely.
There must have come that point. I mean, your first inclination, was it to just go out and conduct a job search?
At first, yeah. I mean, I got a family, I got a support, so I need to find a job. But even getting out there looking, there was temporary jobs was the only thing that was out there. So going back to school was kind of a no-brainer, because everybody was like, well, do you have a degree?
Right.
No.
Yeah.
And it's almost like having a high school diploma.
No. Have you wrapped up your education, or are you still at it?
Nope. I'm actually finishing up my first year. And I probably will have, by the time I'm done, I'll have 2 degrees in probably 3 years.
What other success stories, Dan, besides George's, stick out in your mind?
Well, I think George is a great example for us to remind people that we have a broad and very ambitious goal as a foundation, and that we believe that education in a community is so important that we want to remove financial obstacles to college education for every person. And right now we're privileged to have organizations like Hope Scholars and the Lansing Promise and the Hope Promise. The Lansing Community College Foundation, however, addresses a broad population. We serve students across 15 different school districts in the area. And a lot of people don't realize that, and Georgia's a great example, 60% of the students at Lansing Community College are over the age of 22.
Mm.
And so we have a lot of these people returning, needing to transition into a new career. And these careers require at least some college education. And there's no place for them to turn for scholarships. So we have quite a challenge as a foundation. I think what we're most proud of is that our donors recognize that at a time in their lives when they needed assistance, when perhaps they were single parents or they lost their jobs, that that they want to come forward and help students, and also have the realization that, you know, this isn't just about someone obtaining a dream, you know, as George represents. In today's knowledge-based job market, it's about getting a job, keeping a home, and providing for a family, and for many people, as George is a first-generation college student, moving your family out of poverty to prosperity. And so we're great. We're really happy to see those success stories.
How technically, how has the automotive technology curriculum, your studies, I mean, literally what you study, was it harder than you thought it would be? I mean, I have heard so many times that automotive technology is just, it's changed profoundly with electronics and
yeah,
what have you.
It has changed tremendously. I've been working on cars pretty much my entire life.
Okay.
And when I go back to school, a lot of it was easy. The new stuff, I was actually talking with them today about, you know, people that have been out in the field for 15 years are almost outdated because things change so often.
Well, the computerization in cars alone almost makes you need to be an IT specialist to
yes.
be an automotive mm-hmm. Mechanic anymore.
Everything's going to laptops and you know, plug it in or wireless. And
have you gotten
Bluetooth?
Into that in your training at LCC
yes.
yet? Okay,
yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And I imagine you're going to have to go back for retraining, to
yes.
tell you the truth. I mean, this is just changing too fast.
Yeah, we have other classes, not school classes, but training seminars that people in the field come to the campus to take these training seminars to stay current.
Yeah. Dan, how vigorously do you recruit donors for scholarships? I mean, you conduct a lot of outreach.
We conduct a lot of outreach as best as we can with our budget, and we've been doing a lot of work to try and get people to recognize that we're one of the best-kept secrets in town. And, you know, as we look at the economic success of our community, when we look at our first responders, I think people really have an interest now in supporting what happens locally. People recognize that about 70% of the first responders, fire, police, medic, come from Lansing Community College. In any business you would look at in this town, there's a huge number of people who have received training or degrees from Lansing Community College. I think George and his training represent another aspect of what we do as a foundation. Is we're working now with General Motors to try and get two hybrid vehicles into the automotive technology program so that our students have the latest technology that are there. And every day we have people coming in, a lot of interest these days in making a planned gift through your will or estate. And people every day who come and tell us a story, this is what happened to me when I was a student. This is how I had to get through my college education. And I want to be able to give back and help another student who may be sharing the same struggles.
We're talking with Dan McKean, Executive Director of the LCC Foundation, and George Garza, an LCC student and scholarship recipient in automotive technology. George, do you have too much education to go to have talked to people about jobs, or has that process started?
No, it hasn't really started. I'm concentrating now on getting associate's degrees, not just completion. So for me, I want to remain full-time.
Not just a certification, but a degree.
Right, a degree.
Okay.
And I may decide to maybe waver into being an instructor instead of actually going out in the field. So I want to make sure that my education comes first before I don't want to take too long to get it done.
Right.
You know?
You want it to take the time to invest in your future now,
right.
And delay the gratification,
right.
I guess, is what it sounds like what you're saying. Dan, where is the larger vocational education movement right now, if I can call it that?
Well, there's an awful lot of need in this town for IT professionals, and the college is really working hard to respond to that. When we see the national insurance companies who are in town, they are looking for trained IT people.
Yeah.
Can't fill the jobs fast enough. We've got Jackson National bringing 1,000 new positions to the community. One of the things that LCC and their Business and Community Institute are able to do is respond very quickly to the needs of the workforce. So those things are changing every day, but IT right now is very important, and we're working to get students into that area.
How might our listeners get involved and support what you do?
We would appreciate people with any size of gifts that they might offer, and even work with them to come up with a scholarship that would fit criteria for them. Very easy. Give2.lcc.edu.
Very good. Dan McKean is the executive director of the LCC Foundation. George Garza is an LCC student and scholarship recipient. Great discussion. Good luck to you, and thanks for joining us
today.
Thank
you, Mark.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations. In Current State knows there are great people and organizations out there doing great work, and we just don't know about them. If you'd like to be featured on one of our Neighbors in Action segments, please send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Thanks for joining us here on Current State today. I'm Mark Bayshore. Author Edward McClelland got his start as a writer working on The Lookout, the campus newspaper at Lansing Community College. He now lives in Chicago. McClelland's newest book is Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. He'll visit the Everybody Reads bookstore in Lansing this Saturday. In the book, he recounts the Midwest's industrial growth and decline in the second half of the 20th century. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Edward McClelland about how his Lansing upbringing, especially attending Sexton High School across the street from the former Fisher Body Auto Plant, shaped the writer he would become.
They used to say at one time there was a tunnel between the graduation stage and the line there, but I had a teacher... a chemistry teacher, Mr. Deslich, who he would start his classes every year with a speech. He'd say, it used to be that you didn't have to study and you could just get your diploma and walk across the street and get a job, but that's all over now. You guys are going to have to go to college and get an education. And this was probably around 1982 or 1983 when the auto industry was in a really terrible recession, as I'm sure a lot of people remember. And so even though my family wasn't personally involved in the auto industry, I think the auto industry affects the job prospects of pretty much everybody in Lansing and in Michigan.
The dedication of your book speaks to how your schooling fits in with all of this. So would you read that dedication for me and then expound on it?
Okay. This was to Mr. Matt Mann, a J.W. Sexton High School history teacher who taught me the story of America, and that was a teacher I had for several history classes, and I've already sent him a copy of the book, and he seemed pretty tickled by it, and we learned a lot about the history of industrial America in his class, and he did have an anecdote from the 60s about a student he had. He said the student was just a real chucklehead. And I think he dropped out of school, and he came back one day a couple of years later and pointed at his sports car, and he said, look, that's what I bought from, you know, working in the shop. And Mr. Mann was thinking, well, then look at me. I'm driving my my beat-up station wagon. He said he figured the guy was something like an assistant electrician, and he would hand light bulbs to an electrician. And so those were the kinds of good union jobs you had back in the 60s.
Your book covers lots of Midwestern locales, but I'd like to talk specifically with you about a few sections that deal specifically with Lansing. And let's begin with the prologue about Gus's Bar, taking place in Gus's Bar out by the old plant.
You know, when we were in high school, we would sort of walk by all those bars, but they were kind of forbidden territory. That's where all the auto workers. There was a bar across from every gate. There was Gus's that was on Michigan, and then there was Harry's on Verlinden, and then there was a little further away, there was the Irish Pub on Saginaw, which is now closed. And so I went back there while I was researching the book and was amazed to see that he had somehow survived the closing of Fisher Body. But he talked about how different it was. When the shop was going, I mean, he said people would just jam in after every shift change. You know, they'd shove the money across the bar, and whoever shoved his money furthest got his beer first. And when I met him, he was pretty much the only guy working there. He was working 16, 17 hours a day, living upstairs. He's got kind of a flop house attached to it. And he really wanted to go back and retire to Greece. And he'd actually done so at one point, but the guy who bought it was unable to make it go. So he had to move back from Greece, back to Lansing. And so it was kind of a good metaphor as to what's happened to the auto industry and to the west side of Lansing.
That's right. You return to the subject of Gus's Bar for the last page or two of the book.
Right, right. He said he finally sold it. And I think I asked him, I said, what are they going to call this place when you're gone? Is it still going to be Gus's Bar? And they said, Gus smiled. He had one last joke for the city that had taken away his livelihood. His name got to be Gus, too, he said. He said, I'm going back to Greece. No more of this place. I've been here for 50 years. Right now, Lansing, the most dumb place because there's no jobs.
Chapter 16 of your book, the final chapter of the book, is called This Is Not Your Father's Oldsmobile, and it recounts the story of the end of the Oldsmobile years, Lansing's efforts to keep General Motors in town, the construction of two new plants over the course of two mayoral office holders.
Right. Well, I think one thing that's important to understand, and you know, you want to talk about why Lansing isn't in the shape that Detroit and Flint are, and certainly one reason is that Lansing has a more diversified economy. We've got the university and we've got the state capital. But I think a couple other reasons are, you know, Lansing never really had the racial strife that Detroit had. I mean, certainly when I was going to school, it was almost half white and half black, which I kind of went to school at the peak of integration in America. And I think I read a statistic recently that Lansing has the most multiracial residents who claim an African-American parent. So Lansing is actually one of the most integrated cities in the United States. And I think another reason what differentiates Lansing from Flint is Lansing never had the tradition of labor strife that Flint had. Of course, Flint had the sit-down strike in the 30s, and they never really let go of the spirit of that. So strikes in Flint always lasted longer and were harder to solve, and there was more antagonism between labor and management. And I really think one reason Lansing got two new auto plants was the work ethic and the cooperation of the workforce here. I mean, it's interesting to talk to Lansing auto workers because almost uniformly they will disparage the attitude and the work ethic of their union brethren in Flint.
I wanted to ask you about where you think Lansing fits in with the other Midwestern cities that you visit and talk about in your book.
Well, as I was saying, Lansing is I would say Lansing is in better shape than a lot of these cities. You know, I was when I was growing up, it was always kind of frustrating to me that no one had ever written a book about Lansing, and that's kind of one of the things I wanted to do in this book. But I think one thing I found was that you really can't get an entire book out of Lansing the way you could out of Flint or Detroit or Cleveland or Buffalo. And I think that's partly because of its size and partly because its story just isn't as dramatic as the story of a lot of those other cities, which people living in Lansing should probably be glad for. I mean, Lansing certainly has had about the same level of deindustrialization as a lot of those cities. There used to be 25 or 30,000 people working for GM in Lansing, and now there are about 5,000. It just doesn't take as many people to build a car as it used to. But and Lansing has, you know, pockets like the old Fisher Body Plant that will certainly remind you of deindustrialization, but I don't think it ever really shows the scars of the Rust Belt era as much as a lot of these other cities do.
There may only be 5,000 auto jobs in town, but that's more than zero.
Right, it's more than zero. But you know, the other thing you have to remember about auto jobs is now a lot of them just don't pay like they used to. A lot of the new employees are what they call tier one. So they're starting at $14 an hour, which is not really a middle-class wage. So you can't really depend on an auto job instantly vaulting you into the middle class the way it used to. And of course, GM says that this was something that they had to do to get out of bankruptcy, and they're going to try to promote everybody when they finally can, but I don't think that's really ever going to happen. I think the days when the blue-collar worker and the white-collar worker would make the exact same amount of money, which was how it was when I was growing up, I don't know if that's the future we have to look forward to.
I was going to ask you where you think Lansing goes from here with the two newest plants in General Motors, and yet with fewer jobs and lower pay for those jobs. What do you think lies ahead?
I mean, I think as far as an automaking town goes, Lansing is doing as well as any automaking town can. But I don't think automaking town is going to be central to its identity as it was certainly in the era of the Oldsmobile. And, you know, that GM was the preeminent industry in town. I think now it's sort of more part of the mix than it is the number one job in the city.
The book is Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. Author Edward McClelland will be at Everybody Reads Books and Stuff on East Michigan Avenue in Lansing at 1 o'clock on Saturday, May 18th. And you'll also be, I understand, at the Oldsmobile Reunion at the Secondary Complex on June 15th from 9 to 3. Thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Looking ahead to tomorrow's Current State, meet the CEO of the newly announced East Lansing-based health insurance provider Consumers Mutual. We'll talk with Dennis Litos. Consumers Mutual's plans are geared to new health insurance customers as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Also, author Doc Fletcher discusses kayaking and canoeing in Michigan. We'll also preview the East Lansing Art Festival, where we will be broadcasting live this Saturday from 11 to 1. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry as well, and Aaron Young for engineering. Becky McKendry, thanks for your production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.